Now, in breathing, you know that breath is life. The Greek word, you may pronounce it pneuma or pnefma, is the same as spirit. And spirit means breath. In the book of Genesis, when God had made the clay figurine that was later to be Adam, he breathed the breath of life into its nostrils. And it became alive, because life is breath. But now, if you hold your breath, you lose it. He that would save his life will lose it. So breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, get as much air as you can, and Trishna, cling, and you lose it. So nirvana means breathe out. What a relief that was. The sigh of relief. Let it go. Because it'll come back to you if you let it go. But if you don't let it go, you'll just suffocate. So a person in the state of nirvana is what we might call a blown out person. Like blow your mind. Let go. Don't cling. And then you're in the state of nirvana. And I re-emphasize the point. This is not, I'm not preaching, see? I'm not saying this is what you ought to do. I'm simply pointing out a state of affairs that is so. There's no moralism in this whatsoever. It's simply pointing out, like, if you put your hand into the fire, you'll get burned. You can get burned if you want to. That's okay. But if it so happens that you don't want to get burned, and you don't put your hand in the fire. So in the same way, if you don't want to be in a state of anxiety all the time, and again I emphasize, if you like to be anxious, it's perfectly all right. Buddhism never hurries anyone on. They say, you've got all eternity through which to live in various forms. And therefore, you don't have just one life in which you've got to avoid eternal damnation. You can go running around the wheel and the rat race and play that game just as long as you want to, so long as you think it's fun. But if there comes a time when you don't think it's fun, you don't have to do it. So I wouldn't say to anyone who disagrees with me and who says, I think we ought to engage the forces of evil in battle and put this world to right and so on and so forth and arrange everything in this world so that it's all up. Try it, please. It's perfectly okay. Go on doing that. But if you see that it's futile, then you can let go. Don't try to cling. Relax. And if you do that, you're in the state of nirvana. And you become a Buddha. And of course it means that you become a rather astonishing person. You may, of course, be subtle about it. And make like you're a very ordinary person. So that you don't get people mixed up. Because if you are a very astonishing person, everybody wants to be like you. And they use you as an object of trishna, of clinging. They rely on you. You get a transference on you. Everybody comes running around and says, please help me. I'd like to be like you are. And then you have to get rid of them. See, that's the difference between a doctor and a clergyman. I shouldn't say things like this, but doctors try to get rid of their patients. Clergymen try to get them hooked on the medicine so that they will become addicts to the church. And that's too bad, because there is a saying in ancient Christianity, crux medicina mundi, which means the cross, the medicine of the world. But you don't make medicine a diet. And so in Buddhism, the Buddha explained that his doctrine, his method, was a raft. It's sometimes called a yana. The word Y-A-N-A, yana, means a vehicle, a conveyance. And when you cross a river on a raft, and you get to the other shore, you don't pick up the raft and carry it on your back. You leave it behind. But people who are what I would call hooked on religion are always on the raft. They're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth on the raft. So the clergyman tends to turn into a ferryman who's always on the raft and never gets over to the other shore himself. Now, something to be said for that, because how are we going to get the raft back to the first shore to bring over the other people? See? Somebody has to volunteer to take the back journey. But he must be awfully careful to realize that the real objective is to get the people across and set them free. If you dedicate yourself to ferrying people across, don't ask them to come back on the raft with you. Because you'll get overcrowded, and people will think that the raft is the goal rather than the other shore. So when I find this in actual practice, that when clergymen do not ever ask for money, and it's all right, you know, like a doctor who simply charges a fee, says, you come to me, you pay me so much. But the clergyman says, he doesn't say pay me so much, he says, we would like your pledge, your voluntary contribution. See, and then nobody knows what to give. But he has to go calling around all sorts of places. He becomes a fundraiser for this big project, the church. And it's a bad scene. Because if any church were really successful in liberating people, there would be no problems of economics at all. Because people would keep coming. As soon as you got rid of people, like a doctor who gets rid of people becomes famous. Because they're cured. And so if in a certain church scene, people are cured and they all therefore leave the church, more come in. There's a perpetual tide of more people. So you get a huge turnover. And that's the way to work it. That's the idea of the raft. Now then, the fourth noble truth is called marga. This word means path. And the way of Buddhism is often called the Noble Eightfold Path, because there are eight phases. I won't say steps, because they're not sequential. They're all simultaneous. Once upon a time, there's a very, very great Japanese scholar, D.T. Suzuki, who was giving a lecture at the University of Hawaii on Buddhism and was explaining he'd come to the Fourth Noble Truth. And he said, today we come to Fourth Noble Truth called a Noble Eightfold Path. First step of Noble Eightfold Path called Shoken. He was using Japanese name. Shoken mean right view. Aura Buddhism is right view. Right view mean no particular view, no fixed view. Or Buddhism, Shoken, right view. Second step of Noble Eightfold Path. Oh, I forget second step. You look it up in the book. This man was one of the most terrific scholars in Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Japanese, and so on. So I'm not going to bother you with all the individual steps of the Eightfold Path. It really, all of them are subsumed under three headings, of which you can say that right view, which in Sanskrit is samyag. Samyak is a very curious phrase. It doesn't mean right in our sense of correct. Sam is the same, really, as our word sum. Total. Complete. All-inclusive. We might use the word integrated, as when we say a person has integrity. That a person who has integrity, we mean he's all of a piece. He's not divided against himself. So, in this sense of samyak, drishti, this is related to the word darshan, which means a point of view or viewing. When you go to visit a great guru or teacher, you have darshan, you look at him. And you offer your reverence to him. This is darshan. Many senses of it. But it means simply to view. Look at the view. So the samyak darshan is the complete view. For example, let's take the constellation called the Big Dipper. We look at it from a fairly restricted zone in space. And it always seems, whatever the season of the year, because we're so far away from it, that those stars in the Big Dipper are in the same position. But imagine looking at it from somewhere else in space altogether, and those stars would not look like a dipper. They'd be in another position. Now then, what is the true position of those stars? Don't you see there isn't one? Because wherever you look, the position alters. You could say that the true situation of those stars is how they are looked at from all points of view, all possible points of view. Inside the constellation, looking outwards, outside the constellation, looking inwards, from everywhere and everywhere. But you see, there is no such thing as the truth. The world, in other words, is not existing independently of those who witness it. Because the world is precisely the relationship between the world and its witnesses. Just as the sound of a drum is the relationship between a striking hand and the skin. If there's no skin on the drum, it doesn't make any sound. And so if there are no eyes in this world, the sun doesn't make any light, nor do the stars. So what is a relationship. You can, for example, prop up two sticks by leaning them against each other, and they will stand. But only by depending on each other. Take one away, and the other falls. So in Buddhism, it is taught that everything in this universe depends on everything else. That we have a kind of a huge network, and this is called the doctrine of mutual interdependence. All of it hangs on you, and you hang on all of it, just as the two sticks support each other. And this is conveyed in a symbol which is called Indra's net. Imagine a multidimensional spider's web in the early morning covered with dewdrops. And every dewdrop contains the reflection of all the other dewdrops. And in each reflected dewdrop, the reflections of all the other dewdrops in that reflection. And so ad infinitum. That is the Buddhist conception of the universe in an image. The Japanese call that jiji muge. A ji means a thing event, a happening. So between happening and happening, mu, there is no ge separation. Jiji muge. Now, so the first phase of the Eightfold Path has to do with one's view, understanding of the world. The second phase has to do with action, how you act. And here we get the Buddhist view of behavior. A Buddhist doesn't base his ethics on the idea of commandments, of orders from a higher echelon of authority. Buddhist idea of ethics is based on expediency. If you are engaged in the way of liberation and you want to clarify your consciousness, doing that is inconsistent with certain kinds of action. So every Buddhist makes five vows, five precepts. And you may perhaps have heard the Buddhist formula of taking what is called Panchasila, the five precepts. And they take what are called Tisarana, the three refuges, and the five precepts. The refuges are the Buddha, the Dharma, the doctrine, and the Sangha, the fellowship of all those who are on the way. So the priest, the bhikkhu, the Buddhist monk, and the lay people will chant the formula. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Those are the three refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Then they take the five precepts. Panatipata vairamani sikkhapadaṃ samadhiyāmi, Adinadana vairamani sikkhapadaṃ samadhiyāmi, Kamesu micchacara vairamani sikkhapadaṃ samadhiyāmi, Musavada vairamani sikkhapadaṃ samadhiyāmi, Kamesu micchahara surameriya majapamadatana vairamani sikkhapadaṃ samadhiyāmi. So they take these five precepts. Panatipata. I undertake the precept to abstain from taking life. Adinadana. I undertake the precept to abstain from taking what is not given. Kamesu micchahara. I undertake the precept to abstain from exploiting the passions. Musavada. I undertake the precept to abstain from falsifying speech. Sura Merya Majapamadatana, I undertake the precept to abstain from being intoxicated by Sura, Merya, and Majapamadatana, whatever they were. I presume toddy, which is alcohol. I don't know what else it was. Nobody does know. Because, you see, if you start killing people taking life, you're in trouble. You set up an opposition and you've got to become involved in taking care of it. If you start stealing, you worry people. You upset people's orientation in life, because if you suddenly come into the back home for dinner and find somebody's stolen your table, where are you going to serve dinner? If you exploit your passions, it means that when you feel bored and somehow that life is a little bit empty, You say, well, now, what are we going to do this evening? Let's go and get stuffed. You know, a lot of people who suffer from obesity are trying to simply fill their empty psyche by stuffing themselves with food. Well, it's the wrong cure. So, likewise, musavada, if you start telling lies to everybody, you know what happens when you start telling lies. You have to tell extra lies to cover up the first one, and you get into the most hopeless misunderstanding. Speech collapses. And, of course, the intoxication is the same problem as the exploitation of the passions. So there's a purely kind of practical, expedient, utilitarian approach to morals. There's another side to this which doesn't enter into the precepts, which I will explain later. So that's the third phase of the Eightfold Path. The second phase. Then the third phase has to do with your mind, with your state of consciousness. And this has to do with what we would ordinarily call meditation. There are the two final, the seventh and eighth aspects of the path are called Samyak Smriti and Samyak Samadhi. Smriti means recollection. That's the best English word for it. Now, do you understand the word recollect? Is to gather together what has been scattered. What is the opposite of remember? Obviously, dismember. What has been chopped up and scattered becomes remembered. So in the Christian scheme, do this in remembrance of me. You see, the Christ has been sacrificed, chopped up. But the Mass is celebrated in remembrance. One of the old liturgies says the wheat which has been scattered all over the hills and grows up is gathered again into the bread. Remembered. Go back to your Hindu basis. The world is regarded as the dismemberment of the self, the Brahman. The Godhead. The one is dismembered into the many. So remembrance is realizing again that each single member of the many is really the one. So that's recollection.